Make Me Smart is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million. Hey, everybody, I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood. Welcome to Make Me Smart, the podcast where we're joined, as always, by you, because none of us, especially Kai and I, is as smart as all of us.
This week will be a week of things that are happening in the Trump administration. That is going to be the through line of this podcast from tippy top to down to the bottom of its bottom, because there are so many things that are going on. That's all.
Yeah, exactly. We had a nice departure into the world of summer vacation, and that's over now.
Now you're back.
And now we're back, and we're about to get our fix.
Okay, so I really, really, really feel like we ought to caveat or timestamp this thing up top. And just because, oh my goodness, it is, as I sit here now in Los Angeles, 10:31:58 in the morning on Tuesday. And it's entirely possible, because this has happened to us before, it's entirely possible that before we get out of the studio taping this thing, things will have changed. Mm-hmm. That said, there are some things to talk about, not in the newsiness of them, but in what they mean of them. And that, I think, is where we are. Yes?
Yeah, I think that's exactly where we are. And some of these are themes that came up yesterday during our Make Me Smart editorial meeting, which is broadcast on Facebook Live. And if you don't ever get a chance to come, try to sneak away from work for a half an hour mm-hmm. around noon Pacific or 3 p.m. Eastern, or sometime in between, depending on your time zone. I used to live in Mountain Time for a long time, and I just would get so annoyed. I was like, what? We don't rate it all.
There are four time zones in the United States.
It's on Facebook, facebook.com/Mollywood, facebook.com/Kai Rizdahl, and we post them later. And we found out yesterday that even if you aren't on Facebook, you don't have to be logged in to watch the video.
Yeah,
you just have to be logged in to comment. But if you tweet us, we'll still see it. Anyway, you should check it out.
Also, you can cuss on Facebook Live, I learned yesterday, so that's good.
I mean, I think so. The video's still up, as far as I know. Yeah. So that's exciting, too, if you want to see some cussing.
I said a bad word. We did.
We said the brown word. Anyway.
All right, where do you want to start? There's a whole list of things.
What has come up to me that I think is interesting is watching the Trump team machinations around their behavior during the campaign. Right. The question of cooperation / collusion / conversation, communication with Russia. And I had a yell at the TV moment recently when I saw this on The Daily Show.
You would think, as a patriot, you would say, I may not like Hillary, but I'm an American first. Not I love it.
So that's Trevor Noah on The Daily Show. And he's talking about Donald Trump Jr. receiving an email promising potentially damaging information on Hillary Clinton as part of the Russian government's attempts to help his father win the election. So you all know about that. What I thought was so interesting was that
I'm laughing because how do you not know about that unless you've been literally living under a rock? But anyway,
I mean, you know, I think some people are just choosing the rock choosing the rock. But what I thought was the yell at the TV moment for me was the as a patriot part, because I thought, hold up. And I am not going to suggest that the members of the Trump family are not patriots. What I am going to suggest is that what they are first is business people. I thought, look, let's set aside the conversation about the foreign government interference for a second. if you are a person who has done business, and you know, Mark Cuban had a little tweet thread about this a long time ago, like way back in January, but it was to the effect that, look, Donald Trump sees the Russians as business partners. Mm-hmm. And there's a point at which if you are a certain amount of rich, right? If you're a one percenter and a global capitalist, I think that the mentality starts to transcend questions about country and foreign government interference, and it starts to be transactional.
Well, let me see if I can frame it a different way based on the conversations that we've had around here at Marketplace Global Headquarters in Los Angeles. And that is this. He ran as a businessman. That was his selling point. I'm a CEO. I'm going to make the government run like a business. And we have talked before on this podcast and certainly on the air about how government is not a business. But what we're getting now is not government being run like a business, as most of the American public understands a business. That is to say, a large publicly held corporation that adheres to certain norms and standards. What we are getting is a government run like a business that is a closely held, privately owned family business, which is what the Trump Organization is. And you can see that in any one of a number of ways. Here is the most recent, and it's Anthony Scaramucci, who is the president's new White House communications director, on one of the Sunday talk shows this week. I think it's Fox News, talking about this issue that has frankly bedeviled the White House, which is leaks, setting aside for a second that they come from the president himself most of the time. Actually, that's not true. The president blathers on Twitter, but others in the White House are leaking. And Scaramucci said, listen, one of the things I'm going to do is I'm going to take care of these leaks, and here's how I'm going to do it. And this is what he said on Fox News.
First thing for me is I want to hit a cultural reset button. Second thing is we got to get the leak stopped. If we don't get the leak stopped, I am a business person, and so I will take dramatic action to stop those leaks.
And what that turns into, actually, we have learned since, is that he's going to fire basically the entire White House communication shop because he thinks that's the source of the leaks. The truth is that the leaks are coming from elsewhere in the West Wing. But Scaramucci's response, much as the president's response has been with Jeff Sessions, now you see in the news of late, being at risk for losing his job. Scaramucci's modus operandi here is, I'm going to fire somebody. They're not doing what I want them to do.
Right.
I'm going to fire somebody. And I would just suggest, as in keeping with a long-running theme of this pod, that is not normal in government. It just isn't.
It's not normal, but it goes right back to the idea. It goes right back to the same kind of not normal that you get when you think, oh, well, thanks for this information, business ally. I mean, I think, you know, right. it suggests that the mentality at the end of the day has nothing to do with government, which is not, which I guess I would say is not entirely out of step with the direction of this country right now. I mean, like, Wall Street is booming. Consumer confidence is up. All of the signs that are business oriented are doing great.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's sort of like, which part is not normal at this point?
Yeah, well, I think that kind of behavior from high government officials is the not normal part. Can I pivot, or is there more? Do you have
no? Pivot away.
Okay, all right. So here's another pivot, and this is perhaps unique to me, but I think it goes to the erosion of norms that we are seeing in this White House. It's the President of the United States at the commissioning of the USS Gerald R. Ford, the latest aircraft carrier capital ship in this country. This weekend, and here he is speaking at a ceremonial occasion as the commander-in-chief to an audience largely of military members. Here's the tape.
Now we need Congress to do its job and pass the budget that provides for higher, stable, and predictable funding levels for our military needs that our fighting men and women deserve, and you will get. Believe me, President Trump, I will tell you, you will get it. Don't worry about it. But I don't mind getting a little hand. So call that congressman and call that senator and make sure you get it.
Here it comes. Wait for it.
And by the way, you can also call those senators to make sure you get health care.
So let me just get up on my horse here, if I might. Mm-hmm. I would say I'm going to go off on a toot, but people get upset when I do that. Here's the thing. It is not normal, and it is corrosive to a democratic society when the commander-in-chief takes advantage of a military audience and calls on them to do essentially political acts. I could go way, way longer and deeper on this, but it is a breakdown of the civil-military relationship in this country when that happens. And that is a destructive thing to the norms. I would also point you at, and this is a much less symbolically important thing, but certainly it was a little icky, his speech the other day to the Boy Scouts of America. It was last night. It was Monday night. In which he was telling tales of the New York real estate business and all kinds of different things. And you're like, wait, no, these are kids, man. Don't, what?
Well, also exhorting them to boo the previous sitting president and, you know, chant USA when he said he was going to repeal Obamacare. I mean, that was, I would argue, no less corrupt. Well, okay. There's there's a military chain of command thing that is pretty corrosive. But yes, right? I mean, I guess the point is, I think we talked about this on a really early episode, too. You realize how many of the things that we do are not, they're not codified in any way. They are simply agreed upon social rules.
Right.
I mean, even the codified ones are agreed upon social rules. Right. But it's sort of like you don't do this because it is not protocol or it's not done. We don't know what the long term effect is of saying, I'm over protocol. I'm not interested in that.
Right.
And that is essentially what this election said, for good or for ill. You know, you could say, look, is the problem protocol or is the problem out of control, you know, profit taking from corporations? I don't know. We're about to find out because I think there are going to be, as with any presidential administration, things that coming out of this that will resonate for generations. Steve Pruneau, there was a comment on Facebook that dovetails kind of nicely with that Trevor Noah clip, but also the idea of where loyalty lies at this point, I think. And he says, along the lines of what is normal and make me smart, I'm interested in how our definition of patriotism and loyalty seems to have shifted from loyalty to democracy and our system of government to loyalty to party leaders. And if you don't support the party leader's position, you're treated as an outcast, along the lines of the attacks on Senator Flake from Arizona. And I think that that the point he makes is that the protocol about patriotism itself has changed and about loyalty itself has changed to some extent. I mean, now it's now because we're so divided, it's pretty it's about party.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. And, you know, you watch the healthcare debate in this country literally happening right now. And you see that. All right. So there's a whole Department of Justice riff we could go on, but I don't want to do that yet just because we're going to get to that later in the show. Right. Isn't that right?
A little bit. I do want to point out that in keeping with the eye on the ball thing that we have occasionally brought up here, because about that, you know, speaking of loyalty, one of the things that you've seen this week is President Trump launching a whole series of attacks on Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who may or may not still be Attorney General by the time we finish recording this podcast.
Which is...
because one of the things he's been saying is he shouldn't have recused himself from the Russia administration. I'm really mad at him. I might fire him. Vox has a great piece from Monday of this week about how, and we've been talking about it here for the last couple of weeks, about how effective actually Jeff Sessions' Justice Department is. Mm-hmm. And in fact, Vox goes so far as to say Jeff Sessions is responsible for nearly all of Trump's policy accomplishments. Mm-hmm. And those are things, and we're going to talk about one in particular later in the show, civil asset forfeiture, but those are things that will have impacts for generations. Mm-hmm. And they say, you know, the only reason this guy hasn't resigned is because he is so ideologically committed to the course of action that he has so far enacted as Attorney General, and that it's, you know, it's tough on crime. It's protect the police first. It's take a really, really hard line on things like prison sentencing and immigration and a really softer line on civil rights enforcement. I mean, really profound actions that will have a long-term impact. And I guess fall under some level of normal, right? It's a,
it's
a pretty far-right ideology, but it is an ideology that we've heard before.
Right. We'll get to the bipartisan objections to specifically civil asset forfeiture. But a lot of what Sessions is doing is, as we've said since the very beginning, within the norms for a Republican administration. And with civil asset forfeiture as the exception, a lot of the stuff that's happening, you're like, they won. This is what happens. Elections have consequences. Don't boo, vote.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's some there's been some bipartisan attempts to reform things like mandatory minimums. Right. I mean, he's, you know, his return to the war on drugs. Like, a lot of that is stuff that is farther right than I think moderate Republicans thought they, you know, were on board with. But it isn't outside the realm of normal. And in fact, ironically, given the breakdown in that relationship, Jeff Sessions has probably done more than any single person to define Trumpism. As a governing principle.
Other than the president himself, I suppose.
Well, you know, he changes his mind.
Sessions is the policy guy in terms of getting getting Trumpism into place. And the president and his governing style is chaos. And we're seeing literally in the person of Jeff Sessions, those two come clashing today as the president tweets about how beleaguered and terrible his attorney general is. Yeah, you know,
I know.
And that's what
happens. Whereas Jeff Sessions is probably the single most consistent member of his cabinet.
All right. Anyway, there you go.
There you go. That's what we got. That's what we got for the news fix. I got particularly obsessed with this civil asset forfeiture move, which we're going to stop saying and define and talk about in our next segment.
Okay, so until the president of the United States decided he didn't like his attorney general anymore, the big thing out of the Justice Department the last 10 days has been this decision that Jeff Sessions made about civil asset forfeiture. And as we said, I think last week or 2 weeks ago, whenever the last time we chatted, maybe on Facebook or Twitter, I don't even know, we decided that this was a big deal and we needed to know more about it. So we called Jennifer Doleac. She's an assistant professor of public policy and economics at the University of Virginia, and we got her on the phone.
So let's start at the top. What is civil asset forfeiture?
Civil asset forfeiture is a legal process in which the police or some other law enforcement agency can take your property if it is suspected to have been involved in or purchased with the profits from some illegal activity. And one key point is that the owners of that property don't have to actually be charged with any crime or convicted of a crime in order for the police to be able to seize your property.
Okay, so hold on right there, because that's the thing that's made everybody go, oh my goodness, look at this, the past week
yes.
or two. What is it now that Attorney General Sessions and the Trump administration have done with this policy?
So they've basically returned us to what the policy had been until about 2015. So under the Obama administration, the Department of Justice ended a policy that that was known as equitable sharing that allowed local law enforcement agencies to partner with the federal government to seize assets and then have the revenue from that return to the local police. And so because of concerns about a lot of scandals that had resulted from this policy and local law enforcement that seemed to be sort of recklessly seizing people's assets, the Obama administration ended that particular policy, but that's what Jeff Sessions just started again.
What are some of the other differences? Because as far as I know, it also seems to allow the federal government to engage in civil asset forfeiture, even in states where it's not legal. Is that right?
Right. So under this general policy, individual states often have much more restrictive policies about when assets can be forfeited, what happens to the revenues that that are seized. So if you seize cash or a house or a car and get some amount of money for that, in some states, that money just goes into some general fund, or maybe 50% of the money goes back to the police department. Under the federal equitable sharing policy, up to 80% goes back to the police department. So a lot of local departments will prefer to seize assets in partnership with the federal government in order to sort of skirt more restrictive state policies.
I have read, as this policy burbled up in the news, that there are a lot of police departments across the country who rely on civil asset proceeds for a not small part of their budget. Do you is that your understanding?
Certainly the case that there are a lot of departments that are bringing in a lot of money through forfeited assets. And I think the big question is how much they would have had in their budget otherwise. There are certainly some small departments in particular where, you know, they're sort of anecdotal situations where the amount that they've seized is vastly more than they ever received in their local budget. So in some places, it's a really big deal.
If my civil assets get forfeited, What recourse do I have?
Well, you can challenge that forfeiture, but it's complicated. And if you have the resources to hire a lawyer, then that could be, you might eventually get that cash or that property back, but it's going to take a long time, and you need to get that lawyer quickly.
Yeah.
And so one of the challenges here, and I think one of the reasons this issue has become so controversial, and there have been so many scandals that have resulted, is it really seems like in a lot of situations, police departments are targeting people that they know don't have the resources to hire a lawyer, and often are seizing assets that are relatively small in value, $500, $600. So then even if you have a lawyer, it's not worth hiring him to take that to court, because it's gonna be more than the asset that was seized.
And if you steal enough listen to me. If you if you seize enough $500, $600 assets, that adds up in the budget line and all of that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, steal is an interesting word, right?
Yeah. Hello, Dr. Freud.
At the time that this change was announced, there was a chart floating around that said that Americans have lost more property to civil asset forfeiture than to burglary. Mm-hmm. Does that sound right to you?
That was the most recent number.
Not ethically,
yeah,
right, but accurate.
Right. So I think that was based on the 2014 number. And I think the one caveat to the 2014 asset forfeiture number is that it included some money that came from, I think, the Bernie Madoff settlement.
Oh, wow.
Is in there. So it was sort of an anomaly. But in general, I think the overall punchline, that the amount of money that's being forfeited is a lot, is accurate.
To what extent is this a real problem that happens all over the country? How quantifiable is it versus the you know, pretty shocking anecdotal stories?
Mm-hmm. I think we know a good deal at this point about what's happening at the federal level. What we really know very little about is what happens in terms of assets forfeited just at the state and local level when they don't go through the federal government. And there, you know, you occasionally get a data dump from some local jurisdiction, from some enterprising reporter, or through some other FOIA request. So there was just one that came out of Cook County, Illinois, and some folks mapped it online, and you can kind of see that most of the assets were forfeited in the more disadvantaged neighborhoods. So it really did seem in line with police targeting kind of poorer and minority residents. So in that sense, we have some evidence that the anecdotes that we're hearing are consistent with sort of the broader story, but it is incredibly difficult to get a really clear picture of what's happening at the state and local level, because in a lot of cases, they don't even really collect good data on it, much less make that data public. And so I think a lot of the reforms have actually been in trying to force local police departments to just write down what assets they're seizing and why. And it's been very hard to even get them to do that.
And is that the broader story that in most or many cases, the assets that are seized come from, like you said, people of color, low income populations, people who don't have the resources to fight back?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the reasons that this policy has become so controversial, and that there is such bipartisan support for reforming it. So there you have kind of the libertarians who don't like the idea of the government being able to seize property. And you have people who tend to be more left-leaning who, you know, don't mind the government being really involved. But when it has such a large and negative impact on disadvantaged populations that, you know, don't have the resources to stand up for themselves, that is really disturbing to a lot of people.
So that was Jennifer Doleac. She is at the University of Virginia. She teaches public policy and economics there. There has been a whole bunch written about civil asset forfeiture the past, like 10 days, 2 weeks. There was, though, a piece in The New Yorker about 4 years ago by Sarah Stillman, talked about some of the people and how this affects actual lives and stuff. And it's kind of amazing, truly. Truly is.
It is pretty remarkable. I mean, it is. It's like the plot of Robin Hood is what it kind of is when you get into these stories of what's actually happened to people who were never charged with the crime.
Well, except the other way around, right? It's not taken from the rich and given to the poor. And most times, as Jennifer said, it's taken from the poor and given to the government.
It's before Robin Hood comes into the story is what it is.
Right.
It's the setup. And so, yeah, we're going to have a link to this 2013 New Yorker piece, because it is about a million words, incredibly well researched. And at that point, you know, I think, partly contributed to some of these, as you heard us reference, some of these practices being stopped and put on hold in 2015. And now they're back. So it's a good read. We'll have it on our website, marketplace.org/makemesmart.
You can always get a hold of us, by the way, if you want to write to us. It's makemesmart@marketplace.org. Leave us your thoughts, whatever. Hit us up on Twitter. I was about to say hit me and Molly up on Twitter, but people yell at me when I say that. So it's
hit,
no, it's hit. Yeah, it's hit Molly and me, not me and Molly. I get yelled at. Yeah. No, look, man.
Oh, English.
at Molly Wood, at Kai Rizdahl. Let me spell that because somebody yelled at me for not spelling my name too. It's, you know, it was more of a helpful suggestion than a yelling. KAIRYSSDAL. I'm very sensitive. At Kai Rizdahl is me on
Twitter. He is, guys. He doesn't like feedback
Twitter.
At all.
I know.
That's not true. He likes feedback. Hard.
Only the good kind.
Just the really gentle kind.
Sure.
Yesterday on the Facebook Live, by the way, which you should totally go watch because it's probably one of the funnest ones we've ever had. Yell at me all you want about funnest. we determined, dang it, I totally forgot where I was going to go. Oh, that if you eat a lot of ice cream and then try to spell Kai's name, you will give yourself the giggles for like hours. It's a weird little tongue twister, just spelling his name. So is tongue twister. All right, I'm moving on. Next up. God, it's going to make us smart about interest rates.
God, I hope so.
Thank goodness. But first, we have to pay the bills.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
Get one of the most successful broadcasts in television history on your schedule with the 60 Minutes podcast. Hard-hitting investigative reports, news, and culture maker interviews and in-depth profiles are waiting for you in every episode. Listen to 60 Minutes every Sunday wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we have not done this segment for a while, but we have a great question this week, and it is something that affects us all.
Make me smart.
Make me smart.
Hey, make me smart.
Hi, Kai and Molly. This is David Donati from Baltimore, Maryland. With the recent news regarding interest rates rising, I would love for it to be discussed about its importance and significance, specifically how and why the Fed raises rates, what subsequently happens in the macroeconomy, and what it means for us individuals.
David. How much time do you have? No. So I'm going to do this. Somebody start a clock. I'm going to do this in 90 seconds or less because honestly, any more than 90 seconds worth of Fed monetary policy gets too damn tedious. Great question. The Fed meets this week. The Federal Open Market Committee is the device through which the Federal Reserve Bank of the United States controls interest rates. The key word there being Open Market Committee. So they meet in Washington about 8 times a year, and they talk about what is known as monetary policy, interest rates in this economy. The Fed, as we know, has two mandates. One is full employment. The other one is steady prices, steady inflation. Right now, inflation is at less than what the Fed wants it to be. The Fed wants it to be at 2% plus or minus. Right now, it's something below that, probably about 1.5%, maybe a little less than that. So what does the Fed do when it raises interest rates? What it does is, technically speaking, it raises what is called the federal funds rate, which is the rate that banks charge each other and the Fed charges banks to borrow money literally overnight for cash short-term operations. What that does, though, is that, and it does, it's called open market, by the way, because the Federal Reserve Bank of New York actually goes out onto the treasury bill market and buys and sells treasury notes and treasury bills and government debt to either increase or lower interest rates by controlling how much debt is out there, how much money is out there. What that does in how it trickles down is literally it affects everything. It affects your car loan. It will affect your student loan. It will affect most probably your interest rate on your mortgage because the price of money trickles through the economy. If the Fed raises its rates, then banks raise their rates, credit card companies raise their rates, and literally the cost of money gets more expensive. Now, and I'm going to take an extra 30 seconds here, even though I'm already 12 seconds over time. Why that matters is this. When the Federal Reserve makes money more expensive, it is doing so to control inflation. It's doing so to control rising prices in the fear that inflation will run away, that prices will get excessive. If you remember the 1980s and Paul Volcker with the federal funds rate at like 15%, that was terrible. You were paying like 20% on a mortgage those days, which was terrible, right? So the Fed raises and lowers interest rates to control inflation. When it raises rates, it will generally slow the pace of economic expansion. When it lowers rates, it's doing so in the hope that it will prod the economy to expand more by making money less expensive. When you hear interest rates, think the price of money. Done.
That was amazing.
There you go.
That was amazing.
It was too long, but done.
No, too long for what? For learning?
For my attention span? I don't know. It's monetary policy. Come on.
I mean,
you start talking monetary, you know, snoring, right?
I mean, that's what you say because you're 10 years in, but I was fascinated.
15. All right. Yeah, 15 years in.
See?
I know.
That's why he can do that. That's why he can do that in 2 minutes, just like.
Anywho.
That's awesome.
That's all I got.
All right. We will be right back with some more feedback from you, this time in letter form.
Okay. You know, I like that too. We are back. It is time to hear from you.
Where do we mail a letter?
In the mailbox.
Wonderful emails from you. I'm so happy that people liked our Columbia River bar pilot digression. Ellen Bieberman writes, your interview with the bar pilot was fascinating and eerily coincidental for me. Two nights ago, my husband and I were reminiscing about my time on board the Vega, a 40-foot ketch owned at the time by Greenpeace. On a six-month stint in 1990, our crew of three sailed up and down the West Coast from Seattle to Prince Rupert, B.C. to San Diego, British Columbia. I remember our apprehension about crossing the Columbia Bar. We waited until daylight and the slackest part of the tide. In the event, it was an exceptionally smooth crossing, and a few nights later, as we sailed up the Columbia, I pulled out a recording of some friends singing the Woody Guthrie song that you opened the podcast with. My shipmates were unimpressed. Thank you for bringing that back to mind and for introducing landlubbers to an extremely talented person. Keep up the good work.
That was nice.
Fascinating.
Wasn't that cool? Eitan Herskovich wrote to us. He is a third-year engineering student at Berkeley. He's been a Marketplace listener since he was in the ninth grade, had a suggestion for the book club. Here's what he says, quote, what I have found that works very well, maybe it only works for me, is to set a minimum number of pages to read each day, whether that be 5, 15, or 50 each. And clearly he's talking to me here because I was such a slow starter on Freaking the Righteous Mind. But anyway, each day you read that set number of pages at a minimum. If you have more time, then you can read more. And that's fantastic. The point is you are being consistent. He says you are training yourself to continually read and you are always slowly progressing through your book. Again, a dig at me. Right now, I read 25 pages a day, whatever book he is reading, no matter what. But I didn't always start like that. I began at 10 pages and worked my way up. Once you find your magic number, you will be breezing through books in no time. Well, it's a very engineering person response. Let me just say that.
Yeah, Eitan is a goal. You are a goal-oriented dude.
Son of a gun.
For real.
Yeah.
I feel like that's, all right. I feel like that could be applied to like all kinds of things.
I know,
and also,
right?
It's not just a dig at you because I started out real strong, fell off the cliff, right, and then scrambled to get it done at the last minute, which, right, I think is actually how college is supposed to work, dude.
And mine was driven by shame because I wasn't keeping up with you. So, you know, there's a little competition in there.
See?
There's
all kinds of ways to motivate.
Yeah.
All right. Finally, Scott Lynch writes to us about The Righteous Mind and says, a reminder to all of us, the first purpose of this kind of research and discussion is not to help us understand how our neighbors are captives of their own worldview. It's to remind us that we are. I have come to believe that the hardest thing you can ever try to do is change another person's mind. Consider Einstein's definition of insanity, and before you bash away yet again, ask what you can change in yourself to prevent this interaction from being a repeat of the last one, the one before that, and so on. Oh, and Kai, don't worry about the earbuds on your run. You're never going to hear the mountain lion coming for you either way.
Okay. All right. So I've got a little feedback there for Scott. So number one, yes. No, I totally hear you on the earbuds. I completely agree. Although I've been sidelined with patella tendonitis for 2 months and it's killing me. But to that point about the hardest thing you can ever do is try to change another person's mind. Some of the best advice I ever got was from a roommate of mine in college. Honestly, my best friend in the world. And one of two great pieces of advice he gave me, the first one being, you can never give advice with the expectation it's going to be taken, is item one on the Lichtman rules of advice giving. But number two is, he put it much more saltily than this. He said, you can't screw with somebody on their beliefs. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. when people believe things, you can't mess with them on that because that's what they are. And so I would just offer that as feedback, which is to say, I agree with you. It's really hard.
Yeah. And it was well said, Scott. Thanks for that. And thanks for all the emails. Yeah. They continue the emails, the tweets, the comments. They continue to be amazing and informative. And I cannot believe how smart all of you guys are. And also the hardcore nonfiction that you're all apparently reading.
Oh, I know, right? Come on.
I immediately fled
Speaking
to the safety
of
sci-fi, but okay.
Man in the High Castle, that's all I'm saying. Would have been a much. I would have read 50 pages of that, by the way.
I loved The
I'm
Righteous
just
Mind. That was a useful and mind-opening conversation in book. It was totally worth reading. And now we're going to let it go.
Bah humbug, that's all I'm saying.
Now we're going to let it go, Kai.
Okay. Consider it gone.
Thank you for listening to our show and emailing us and talking to us. If you have a moment, we'd love it if you could put some of those thoughts into text form and review us on Apple Podcasts or just tell a friend or find us on Twitter. Keep talking to us.
Deep intake of breath followed by this. Make Me Smart is produced by Jenny Josephson and senior producer Nancy Fargali. This week's program was engineered by Brian Allison. Our theme music is composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez. Which version of the music do we have?
What will it be? The executive producer of Marketplace is Sitara Nieves. The senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark. I feel like one of these days it's just going to be something crazy like Schoolhouse Rock. Like it's just going to be all, I'm just a bill.
That'd be funny, right? I'm just a bill. Here on Capitol Hill. Oh, it's the standard. It's the standard, just, I think.
This is my favorite part.
And change. No, that's it.
That part, I did a little flash dance style run, like chair run in place.
Do you really?
Yeah, oh yeah.
No dancing. That's my favorite note right there.
Bing. I know. It's just so good.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.